Off the ball
on News Talk
in association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
And now from the RDS, this is Off the Ball Live, featuring Peter Schmeichel, Shay Given, and Brian Kerr. But first, would you please welcome on stage, it's a hat-trick of hotness, Nathan Murphy, Kevin Caban, and Kenny Cunningham.
Short head. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
Hello, the RDS. Are we going to the World Cup? Are we going to the World Cup?
Yeah, that was
That's more like it. You are very welcome along to the Off the Ball Roadshow. All with thanks to our good friends in Carlsberg, proud partners of the Irish football team. What a lineup we have for you tonight. It is a first ever Off the Ball Roadshow for one Kenny Cunningham.
Well, woo.
Lucky the Great British Bake Off finished last week. You had a spare time on your Thursday evening to grade us with your presence.
Yeah, time to kill. I'm impressed with the tour now, I must admit.
We also have Kevin Caban here.
Hello.
Kevin has a very early start tomorrow morning. He's going to be on the flight at 5:15 to Copenhagen.
They've already taken 15 minutes off me tonight. Nathan said it was 5:30. Now it's gone to 5:15, so I'm not happy with that, yeah.
And somebody in our crowd is also going to be going to Copenhagen this weekend because, Kenny, we have a very special crappy quiz coming your way at the end of tonight's show. It is all with thanks to Carlsberg, proud partners of Irish football for the last 20 years. And it's a trip for two people to Denmark. You get tickets for the match, you get overnight accommodation, and you'll also receive passes to the Carlsberg Experience in Copenhagen, where you can enjoy a pre-match pint for the game. So that is all coming up a little bit later. You've all been told how to enter and all that, and we'll have a runners-up prize as well. Whoever loses the crappy quiz will get to go to the home leg, which is just as important on Tuesday night. We've introduced two of our guests. We've also got Brian Kerr coming up. We got the one and only Shay Given coming up. Apparently he's got a book out. Haven't heard too much about
it. Definitely only one of him. I know.
No, he told me. He told me there's a book somewhere along the line. Anyway, yeah. Shay's book has gone number one. Yeah.
And we also have the great Peter Schmeichel coming your way in just a moment. We are very, very excited. No, we're going to give him a cheer for tonight. We can boo them as the weekend goes on, but we give them a cheer tonight. We're very excited to have Peter Schmeichel. He is a bona fide Premier League legend. Like, when you're thinking of greatest Premier League teams, sometimes you might have debate about the attackers, whether it's Shearer or whether you're going to go, maybe now you go for Harry Kane, maybe you're going to go for Suarez,
Kev left wing,
Thierry Henry. Like, would you go for Dennis Irwin or Ashley Cole at left back?
Oh, Dennis all day.
All day long.
100%.
All day.
There is never any debate about the goalkeeper's position. It is Peter Schmeichel every single time. And when you think back of the glory days of the Premier League, Peter Schmeichel was there for most of the great moments. Like, I'm thinking famous goals. David Beckham from the halfway line. Peter Schmeichel, he played in that game.
Ekoku.
Watch the top of the screen.
And Beckham saw Sullivan off his line. Oh!
One of the great Premier League goals.
What a strike. Absolute. That's an iconic moment. Iconic moment, but...
That was a good team they're up against as well. Wait. That was a quality team.
What was that up in the corner? Roll it back. Up in the corner. Let's have a look here.
Peter
Schmeichel is just down there. Yeah. Kevin Ekoku loses the ball.
Have a look at the Wimbledon right back. Good cover position.
Kenny, you should have been at cross covering. You should have got there quicker.
Oh, Ken.
Perfect positional sense.
Yeah, that's it. Ready for the diagonal.
Ready for the diagonal ball. Waiting for the diagonal.
Beckham had the ability to hit that diagonal ball.
Like, there was a touch of luck with that. You can never know for sure when you're shooting from
the halfway
line.
Where's this going?
My favourite Premier League goal of all time. Technically, without question, the best. Paolo Di Canio. That was a strike.
Went wide nicely.
Now playing left back. I'm playing left back this time. No, I'm not. I'm playing right back.
Over Cunningham. Di Canio. I do not believe that.
That's where your body language is looking at the player saying, go on then, have a shot.
What did Martin Tyler say? Over whose head? Wait, let's just see it one more time. Whose head could this ball have been floated over?
It's not too bad a position.
Kenny, body shape. body shape, Kendall.
He opened up. Opened
the shoulder. Right shoulder.
What a strike.
It was a great goal. It was a great goal.
Are you having that one, Kev?
Well, it is. I think that's an iconic goal from the Premier League. My personal favourite.
There's a few more.
Who can forget?
There's a couple more.
Tony Yeboah.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, Tony Yeboah.
Oh, check out this
Tony
one.
Tony Yeboah.
What a header. Oh, foot like a traction engine.
Oh, what a goal.
What really made that goal, though, Kev? I think if you look back, Kev, what really made that goal was the assist.
Yes.
The cushioned header.
Who was that again?
Kenny's in
with the assist.
If I don't hear that, the winger's in.
Oh, Kenny.
Come on, lads. Cut me a bit of slack there. Cut me a bit of slack.
Ah, Kenny. It's been great to have you here for the road trip for the first time. We've been saving this up for a while.
Yeah.
You're going to be back in a while. We're going to talk a lot about Ireland. Just before we go, though, because we're getting Peter Schmeichel on in the moment. Like, Peter Schmeichel was a goal-scoring goalkeeper. And we had a quick look around, and like, there was one very special goal Peter Schmeichel scored. You would appreciate this one as well.
Schmeichel's up. He's on his
way. That's not me. That wasn't me.
European tie against Volgograd.
Peter Schmeichel, goalkeeper going forward.
Or anyone now. Pallister up.
Overhead kick in the last minute.
Well offside there, isn't he?
Offside.
Well offside.
Just about given offside, Kenny, there. I think you might have been patrolling the back four to squeeze him out.
I don't know what game that was. Could we have one more look at it and see? I don't.
That's definitely not me. That's not you.
You wouldn't have been there. You would have been marking Peter Schmeichel.
I'm going to get ringed again.
Wait, one more time.
Or anyone now. Pallister up.
Oh, Kenny. You've been a witness to history, Kenny.
I've got
many
fingers like that.
Times. Is there any we've missed?
There's more.
There's more, Kendall.
Kev, there's more.
You're going to be back in a little while, Kenny, to talk about Ireland. But right now, let's get our very special guest on stage. Give it up, please, for Peter Schmeichel.
Well done.
Hey, Peter.
Nice to meet
you. What was that?
Yep.
Yep, it's big enough.
You just missed your overhead kick there against Wimbledon.
Eh?
You just missed your overhead kick against Wimbledon.
That was a decent finish.
It's a good goal, wasn't it?
You scored quite a few goals.
I knew it was offside.
Did you? Straight away?
Straight away.
How many goals did you score during your career?
A lot.
13?
I don't know, because when I was a younger pro, I used to take penalties for my team, and it's kind of before records, you know. So I've tried to look into it. I think it says 11 somewhere. So
why did you go penalties?
So I'll go with 22. Sorry.
What did you say to the manager when you decided that you were taking penalties?
I was very good at it, by the way. I used to just kick it as hard as I could. And then I transferred to Bromby, and we had a spell where we literally got a penalty in every game. And we literally missed a penalty in every game. And eventually it came around to my turn. And I'm saying, I'll show you guys how to do it. And I missed the worst penalty ever. I mean, I seriously missed the tie. And it should be impossible, you know, but I missed it about 5 yards. So since then, I was off penalties.
You scored the first ever Premier League goal for a goalkeeper when you went back to Aston Villa. I think you scored against Roda Velograd for Manchester United.
Top corner.
But you also, anytime Manchester United were behind, you were up in injury time. Was the intention, I want to get my head on the end of this, or was it, I can just cause complete havoc?
Yeah, I think the last one, yeah. I was never really keen on heading the ball, to be completely honest. I didn't like that. There's a lot of focus on that these days, where Alan Shearer's gone, you know, he's at the front of that. But, you know, I seriously didn't like heading the ball. So for me, it was just come out, you know, cause some havoc, cause some confusion. And you know, we were successful at times by doing that, so...
Yeah. Did you just take it upon yourself to go up there? Did you actually have to get the acknowledgement from
Alex? I've been doing it all my life.
Yeah.
All my life, even when I was a kid, I used to do that. So it was just something I did. And I mean, Sir Alex was a great manager. He wasn't someone who said, oh, we have to do this and you can't do that. If you came up with an idea that for him seemed to be okay, then carry on, by all means.
Yeah. I watched an interview you did with Oliver Kahn where you watch back the 1999 final, and he was talking about your presence in the box before Teddy Sheringham's goal, how Bayern Munich were such an incredibly well-organised defence. I think they'd just taken off Lothar Matthäus, but you go up, suddenly there's nobody to organise the defence. Teddy Sheringham is free, Ryan Giggs is free. Like, yeah. No better time for it all to come together perfectly.
No, I seriously think that Ottmar Hitzfeld, he made a big mistake with his substitutions. He should never have taken Matthäus off. He's just orchestrating the whole thing. And I can't believe he did that. They are coincidences, and you have to take advantage of those situations. And so we did. But me coming up, they were very, very well organized. All throughout that game, we were struggling to create any kind of chance, that we could score from. We had little sniffs and little opportunities. But once he got off, and we get this corner, I came up, they were all like that. They were very, very doubtful of, what am I doing?
Who's more than going? Aware of that panic on the pitch at the time yourself, then, were you? Yeah.
Well, exactly, you know, and that's nothing better than being organized. And, you know, yeah, let them have the corner because we organized, you know, and having that feeling. But there's nothing worse than being taken out of that sort of feeling. And sometimes you are. And they were in that game. And, it's also the fact that you're thinking, is he really taking him off? You're like, that's a chance. And then you look out, the next thing you see is Teddy coming on. You think, oh, yeah. And then Ole Gunnar, you think, yeah, now we've got a chance, you know. So these kind of things build up as well and gives you extra confidence, extra energy to go and pursue that goal.
Because people talk about Fergie time as being what should be 3 minutes of added time ending up being 6 minutes of added time. But really, Fergie time, it feels like, was the sense of Manchester United are coming for you.
Fergie
when
time
they're behind.
Is 9 minutes.
Every
it's
time.
9 minutes, and it comes of a game where the referee got injured. We played Sheffield Wednesday at Old Trafford, and it was a season we won the first championship, and it was a game we needed to win. We played awful. The pitch was awful. The ball we played with was heavy. And you remember those days? You couldn't move that ball 2 yards. So the referee got an injury, and he came off. But it took about 6-7 minutes to get the change going. And the new referee comes on. And the first thing he's doing is giving Sheffield Wednesday a penalty. So we are 1-0 down within a minute of changing the referee. And then Brucey scored the two goals in the 9 minutes of added on time. From that comes Fergie time.
Did you carry that weight of expectation when you went to United? You know, that was your first title in such a long time. Did you sense that around the dressing room, that nervousness was around the squad?
Not so much around the dressing room, because the dressing room was full of confidence. Manager was very good at saying, we will win the championship. We are on course to win the championship. And literally, my first season was the last of the old first division. And we should have won the championship. I mean, we were much better team than Leeds, but for some reason we just couldn't play in the last 3 weeks. We just gave silly points away, and we had 4 games in 1 week, and 3 of them were the teams that got relegated, and we got 1 point from that, 2 points from that. And to win the championship, that's not good enough. So, I seriously felt around Manchester United supporters that not again, you know, we're so close and not again. And then once that first Champions, the first Premier League was
what,
won.
What changed in the dressing room then? What changed during that season?
I think Eric was the important one. Eric came in with a difference. You can't be saying any other word. He was different. And that difference, everyone else, all the other teams, they had a hard time dealing with that. And Eric was scoring goals where we needed goals, and the team that we had was fantastic. We had a really, really good team. We got loads of pace, Kanchelskis, Giggs. We had Paul Ince playing midfield with Brian McClair, so we had a great engine. Mark Hughes, fantastic up front. But we needed someone who could, in games, like the 3 games we had in those 4 where we only got 2 points, someone who could just break the deadlock and just get us that elusive goal. And Eric did that.
Did you room with Cantona?
To begin with. Back then, we shared rooms, and then with about two or three years later, we all got individual rooms. So
what was rooming with Eric like?
Sorry?
What was rooming with Eric like?
It was brilliant. Eric is a fantastic fella. He's a really nice guy. Eric is an actor. So what you guys know is the actor. He's playing a part, and he's doing that really well. But basically, he's like everyone else.
Did he switch it on and switch it off when the cameras were on?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
And when the cameras were off, was he a more gentle character?
No, but Eric, you have to remember, Eric really was the first big superstar of the Premier League. And with that came all the attention. And when you have that much attention on you, you need to sort of not be yourself. You've got to sort of create someone that you're not in order to live with that. And that's what he did. And he was brilliant at it.
Did he need protecting? Did you ever have to, as a team, try to protect him away from the club when you were maybe out on functions or anything like that?
Yeah, a little bit. Football was a lot different. Mm. And popularity with players and stuff were a lot different back then. We could easily go out for a team meeting in Manchester and be left alone. That can't happen today. You know, today you need the big security, and all the social media weren't there, so rumors didn't spread as well or as quickly as it does today. So we were really sort of a tight knit group of players who all wanted the same thing. And I think what made Eric good for Manchester United was, first of all, he had a manager who understood him, and he was letting him do exactly what Eric wanted to do. He's never had a manager. He had 11 clubs in France before he came to England. So he had 3 clubs in England. We were the third one. And also he had teammates who respected him and didn't look at him as some sort of freak or someone on the outside.
You said it was a different time as well. It was fairly... At that time, you didn't see too many stories of United players coming out and about. You know, the odd one that would come out, it'd be smaller stories. So what then did change when all these stories then started to circulate further down the line? And what did change then around the game at that time?
Social media.
Yeah?
Social media. I can't see how players can live with that now. I mean, it's everywhere they go. We both lived in Old Liege. And back then, you know...
I rented your house. Let's just clarify that.
He still owes me rent, by the way.
Peter Schmeichel was actually my landlord at one time, yes.
I was going to get onto that.
When was this?
But it's only 23 minutes past 7. I wasn't waiting until about 8:30.
Yeah.
But back then, you could go down to Old Liege, have lunch, do whatever you want, and be left alone. If you go down to Old Liege now, you've got paparazzi on every corner now. You've got tourists coming down. With their cameras and autograph books, and in the hope of, I tell myself it's a football player, but I know deep down it's the Cheshire Housewives.
that almost be a world away from where you started, because unlike probably most of the players we have here tonight who started as professional footballers and were with clubs at 14, 15, you did have a life before football.
Yeah.
You were what, 22, 23 when you turned pro?
Professional football was invented in Denmark, or introduced in Denmark, in 1986. And by then, I've already been a semi-pro for 3 years.
What was the name of your local club?
Hvidovre. So that's what was my first club. But we all had jobs, you know?
You worked for the WWF?
Yeah.
The World Wildlife Foundation,
yeah.
That was.
I'm not a wrestler.
You could have been, I suspect.
I could have been.
And all that time, are you thinking, I want to be a professional footballer?
I actually started out as an apprentice carpet fitter. And I stayed with it for a year. And it was too hard for my knees and my back. But the club I was playing for, we were playing in the best league. When I was working this job, they've been the champions of Denmark 3 years prior to that. So, you know, high level. And I could work from 8 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, you know, gluing carpets and stuff like that with whatever that is, you know, with the materials we use, not very healthy, and then play in the Super League in the
evening. You were as high as a kite when you were going to play that evening then, what it was, yeah?
It happened. It was what it was like that. And I'm really happy I did that. I'm happy I had a variety of different jobs before I became a full-time professional football player, because it sort of given me a perspective of life and an understanding of how lucky I was that I could live by playing football. I could make my living of when I actually went in and became a professional full-time player, I made less money than when I worked and played football. But I didn't care. That was all I wanted to do.
You went to Bromby when you turned professional, and you had brilliant success there. I think it was four titles in 5 years. Was that, in your mind, the height of your ambitions, that you'd fulfilled your goal, getting to play professional football in Denmark, or straight away had you the confidence that you were looking abroad, you were thinking, I can go on to greater things than this?
I tell you what, my ambition was formed when I was 8 years old, and I don't know where it came from, because we didn't really have that much TV, and nothing was reported in the newspapers, and I probably couldn't read by then anyway. But I wanted to play an FA Cup final for Manchester United. That's what I wanted. So that was always, you know, what I was aiming for. So for me, Bromby was a stepping stone, and in my first conversation with him about signing for them, I kept saying that, you know, I only want to sign 2 years because I want to move on. And I ended up signing 4 years on the promise that after 2 years, you know, I could go. But it was football as a professional sport was brand new, so they wanted all the best players in Denmark signed for 4 years so they could sell sponsorship. And I believed them. I believed in them. So I stayed for 4.5 years.
Graham Souness has a book out at the moment, and he was mentioning how he missed out on signing you, that you wrote Liverpool a letter offering to pay for...
I'm so happy you asked this question.
In case anyone hasn't heard it, what he says was that you wrote a letter to Liverpool offering to pay your own expenses to travel to Liverpool for a trial, and they said, you're grand, thanks, because they just signed David James.
Yeah, not true. No, well, if you look in history, David James came to Liverpool after I came to United, so you know there. Now, the crazy thing about this story is that, first of all, it's completely untrue, by the way.
Do you have to say that now as a United legend?
I'll do it again. It's completely untrue. I work with Graham Souness from time to time on. And he claims it was him. So I've sent, he puts this in his book, that I wrote a personal letter to him, okay? So, and I didn't, but never mind that. When it came out again, which is only like 2-3 weeks ago, it was it was Ron Yates. I don't know if you noticed that, but then it was Ron Yates who relayed this story to Sue. So he's sort of moving away from it now. But it's in his book, so he can't sort of move away from it. And it's been a big deal in Denmark, and it actually is a little bit annoying, because I never did. But I tell you what, and where I think this could have come from, is that we played Wales in Copenhagen, and Jan Mølby obviously played for us, and he played with Ian Rush. And afterwards, I met up with Jan and Ian Rush, and I made this incredible save from Ian Rush, and he's like this, you know. And we won the game 1-0. And it was a qualification game as well. And he's like this. So I say, whew. And he said, you should come. And it was Bruce Grabberline goal. He said, you should come and play for us. And I said, tell the manager then. Because, you know, anything to go abroad, that was sort of what was going on in Denmark. You'd do anything to get abroad. And Liverpool were actually winning a lot of championships back then. So I just said that. And I like you guys.
They get it.
Did you see Gary Neville's tweet? Carragher, he's celebrating the 125 years of Liverpool's history. When Gary Neville said, the first 100 years were good.
You're not wrong there. How did the move to United come about then? Was it a personal call from Alex Ferguson?
What happened with Bromby, we were in Spain, we were doing pre-season training, and this is when Ferguson was having a little bit of trouble with the team and the performances, and they were playing this game to get to the FA Cup final. So he took them away, and he's been watching me training, and he's like this. And my agent has already at that time been knocking on his door saying, you gotta see this kid. So he started to send Alan Hutchinson, the goalkeeping coach, over to watch me. And they agreed that I was the guy they wanted to...
Was that just in training rather than games? Was he watching you in matches?
He was watching me train, and that was the first time he laid eyes on me, you know, and seeing this crazy Dane who's, you know, jumping everywhere, you know, screaming and shouting, and he's... I kind of like him, you know, and he sent the goalkeeping coach to watch me about, I think, about 10 times, and he's come back every time, like, you've got to sign this kid, he's good, you know. So we got to a point where they put a bid in for me, and my club, going back to the 4 years with a two-year promise, my club was very greedy. They wanted £1.2 million for me, which was a lot of money. And they will.
You're probably worth it.
No way Martin Edwards would pay that. So it didn't happen, and I was devastated, completely devastated. So one day, I get a phone call to come to my agent's assistant's house in near where we trained. And I come in, and Ferguson is there. That's the first time I meet him. And he's taken the morning flight from Manchester, gone straight to his house, and you know, I met him. He stood up, shook my hand, said, listen, I know it didn't come to anything, but I'm going to come back for you in the summer. So play well, keep progressing, and I see you in the summer. Shook my hand and left. And I'm like that. What happened there? And that was the first time I met him. So that one meeting with the man made me 10% better, and I actually had my best year in Denmark from that point and onwards. And, you know, that's the effect of the great man, you know. You only have to look at you.
Talking then and mashing it all together, Liverpool, Manchester United, Ferguson, what happened after the Liverpool game, the 3-3 draw, where he ends up sacking you, it seems, leave.
I shouldn't really tell the story because it's in my book and I want you all to buy my book.
Well, this will tempt them. There's many stories like this.
What was really great about him, I mean, everyone knows about his temperament, you know, and it could get really really bad at times, but if he was having a go at you, you could always go back at him, and he wouldn't mind that. Actually, he liked that, because it was not really having a go at me as an individual. It was more letting off steam and getting all his frustrations out. And once that was done, he was fine. He never, ever, ever went back to it again. But on this occasion, we play Liverpool at Anfield, and we are 3-0 up in 20 minutes, and we should be 7-0 up by halftime. But we come in at halftime 3-2 up, and we just completely stop playing. So he makes the adjustments and has his halftime team talk. Then we go back out, and we're no different. So we were actually quite lucky to get a 3-3 draw. Neil Ruddock scored the equalizing goal. So I played really well in the second half, I have to say that. And if I hadn't played that well, then we would have lost maybe 5-3. So he comes in and he goes straight at me. And the thing he goes at me for are my goal kicks. You know, my goal kicks are 80 yards up to Neil Ruddock's head, and he heads it back every time. And I'm like, 80 yards? I mean, come on. I can't do better than that. Where do you want me to put them, right? Yeah, but Neil, get the second balls. And then he starts to get, you know, I should have realized all he wanted to do was let off steam. And he picked me because he thought I could handle it. But that was just the wrong day for me, because I was so frustrated with the way we played. And a lot of players didn't play from 3-0 and onwards. And I was very, very frustrated with them as well. And I couldn't understand why I had to take, you know, the fall for everyone. Mm. So I said stupid things. You have to picture this scene, by the way. He's having a go at me. We like this. But as I'm getting undressed.
So you're naked.
Eventually, he's got a cup of tea in his hand, by the way. There's no threats there, no words, no spoken threats, but a little tip of the cup. I'm not saying anything other than with my eyes saying, yeah, try me. So I turned my back to him, went out and had a shower, and then it was really bad. And then on Monday morning, he calls me into the office and said, listen, can't have this. You know, you can't speak to the manager like that in front of the other players. And I said, I agree, and I apologize. He says, you know, I have to sack you. You can't have a player like that. Just can't. Just, okay, fine. You know,
what was your reaction to that?
I was still furious. I mean, he was never going to sack me. I knew that.
All right.
But I was still... I was still fuming, and my ears and my nose were still red, you know. So, but I knew I had been out of line, you know. I had crossed a line that I shouldn't have done. I was completely out of order. So he came down and had a team meeting, and he was furious with everyone. And then he left, and I said to everyone, listen, I'm really sorry. I embarrassed all of you. I embarrassed the manager and I myself as well. And I should never have said anything. I should just have let it go. So I'm really, really sorry, guys. And then we went out for training. But what I didn't know was that he was outside the door listening in. So this is what he told my agent was, I couldn't sack him after that. You're such a sweet boy.
Just on that confrontation, what struck me about it was that, so the dressing room, say, you went into was full of big characters, Robson, Bruce, yeah. Pallister, Hughes, and you get bigger characters as you continue with Cantona coming in, with Keane coming in. Were those types of confrontations, were they not regular occurrences at United?
No, not really.
Did nobody speak back? Was that unusual?
Not really. We were all, I think we were all amongst the best players in the league. We're all on top of our own games. We all realized that you know, the combination of us is the best that we have in the country. And if we really put our heads to it and concentrate on what's important, playing football, then we will win a lot of trophies and a lot of, you know, have a lot of success. So we didn't really have that. There's hardly ever been any fighting in the vicinity of Manchester United. Bromby, we had at least a fight between players every week. And more often than not, it was the same two guys. Best friends, by the way. But once they were training, they just wanted to win so much.
So was it respect for each other at United or fear of Ferguson?
I would say that, definitely, yes. I don't think many people socialized when the younger players, the class of 92, when they came into the dressing room and became senior players. Obviously, you had a big group there that did, you know, socialize outside football. But most of us were brought from different parts of either the UK or in my case, from Denmark, and we did have our own stuff. We brought our own families in, and you know, we had different lives and lives outside football. I made a big point of having a life outside football.
You're a landlord.
So yeah, I'm a landlord.
Exactly, yeah. A high-paying landlord as well.
Hard one. Yeah.
We're definitely getting into this before you go home tonight.
I've got pictures.
Go on. You've got pictures? It's starting to get a little bit weird. I wanted to talk to you about the 99 Champions League final. And whenever we talk about that here, we always talk about Roy Keane missing it. And you got the captain's armband on what is your final ever game for Manchester United, and what a way to bow out. Is there I'm sure there's no ceremonial handing over of the armband, but with Roy being captain for the entire season, are you in conversations with him around the final? Does he speak the day of the final? Who takes on? Who is he the captain in the dressing room at all still, or are you fully in control?
It doesn't work like that, because if you look at our dressing room, you have 20 candidates for the captaincy. It wasn't really that important a thing. Obviously, in a game like that, when you play for a trophy, you win it, you lift the trophy, that's an important event. But really, you know, and this is what Ferguson was really good at. He was bringing in people that, you know, every single one of them could become captains. And it's not like in rugby or in cricket, where the captain is a very, very powerful person. That's not the way it works in football. I can't remember. I mean, okay, Robbo probably was one of the last very, very powerful captains, but I don't know if you played anywhere where the captain just,
fair enough,
you know, he comes in and he decides everything. That's not the way it works. And it definitely wasn't a ceremony in any way, but it's actually the most sort of subtle I've ever seen, Roy. Because obviously it was a big game to miss, and it was a massive problem for us. People don't realize how big a problem it was to miss him. Not only him, but Paul's goals as well. So we had to make far too many changes to actually put 11 players out. So with the whole center midfield gone, we then had to put David Beckham in center midfield with Nicky Butt was a fantastic player. But David Beckham was not a center midfield player. So in order to, again, to put the player enough players out to keep the shape, we had to put Jesper Blomqvist left wing and Ryan Giggs right wing. So by putting Beckham inside, we missed all his crosses, which was such a big part of our game. By taking Ryan over there, Ryan was an okay cross on his right foot, but a much better play on his left foot. But he also took the threat away from the left-hand side, because Jesper was a different player. Jesper was a fantastic player, but he was not Ryan Giggs, because no one is Ryan Giggs, you know. So those changes in reality meant that the game panned out the way it was. A lot of insecurity, not many chances created. And when you think about the number of chances that we created in that season, we constantly created chances. We had, you know, we had no service into to Dwight York or Andy Cole. They had no real opportunities to score goals. And that came from missing those two players.
When you say Roy was quite subtle around the place, around that final, is that in terms of that he took a major step back?
Yeah, I know, you don't believe that. Yeah, no one believes that, yeah. But it's the truth. He was.
That he just wasn't involved at all. Do you think that was down to the devastation of missing it?
He was around the team, and he was in the caring mood, can I say that? In a caring mood, which we hadn't seen before.
Is he going around giving you hugs?
No one's seen him like that before, you know. And also after the game, we had to sort of bring him onto the pitch. He didn't want to come onto the pitch. Which,
unlike one or two players wearing the shirt and things like that, to lift up the trophies and things, yeah?
Well, he could have done that, you know. David Mays had no shame. He's in every picture with it. So why not?
Yeah.
You would think David Mays played every game with me, wouldn't you?
That's your final game for United. Do you then leave United?
He's in the 68 one as well.
Yeah. His behaviour around that final then and your final game, did you leave with a different impression of him as a character compared to what you probably had to deal with for the previous six years with Roy, of what type of character he was with the way he acted around the final?
Did I leave with it? No.
He was still the same guy. I'm getting the debts there. We see the celebration and you're doing the somersault. Like, you've just had the most incredible 10 days. You've won the league, you've won the FA Cup, you've won the Champions League. Is there not a slight tinge of regret that you're now leaving it all behind?
It's so weird, right? So what you do is you build up. We had a game, I have to go back to just before Christmas. We have a game against Middlesbrough at Old Trafford. It's the only game in my whole career at Old Trafford or at Man United where Salah wasn't there. He was ill that day. So we lost this game 3-2. And we played so bad. We were really, really poor that day. And we're in the dressing room, and we're kind of embarrassed because, you know, our father's not here, and we've, you know, been naughty young boys, right? And we kind of agreed that we're not gonna be this bad anymore. We have to pull ourselves together, and we've gotta win. Actually, let's agree now that we're gonna win the rest of the games. Let's win every game from now on. And we're all, yeah, okay, we'll do that. So it starts as a joke, you know? Something to bring us back up, because we've got Christmas coming up, another 7 games in 2 days. So let's win the rest of the game. So we started, we counted the potential number of games. I can't remember how many it was. Okay, we've got 40 potential games left. If we win 40 games, we would have had the most incredible season. And that started like that. And for every game we played, it became one less, but it was said. And then you end up with 3 games to go. Right, you've got one in the league, you've got one in the FA Cup, and you've got one in the Champions League. And let's just, for argument's sake, say that it was 40 games we started with. So 37 games were fairly easy to get through. Now you've got three, and the climb is that steep, and you have to go and win them. You have to go and win them, and you know you will have had the most incredible season and done something that no one else has done. So we play Spurs at home. We're 1-0 down. Les Ferdinand scored. And something kicked in. David Beckham puts it in the top corner. Andy Cole scores this. I don't know if you remember this, but it's an incredible takedown, and then he tips it over the goalkeeper. And we're 2-1 up, and that's enough. We know half an hour to go, they won't score again. Spurs. We're winning this. So we won it. Celebrate a little bit. Someone celebrate a little bit more than others, which I'm not going to get into.
Names.
On the Monday night.
Were you one of them?
I'm not saying. then we get to the FA Cup final, and we play Newcastle. Newcastle desperate to get the trophy, you know? And it was like they never turned up. It was so easy for us. And we all like this in the dressing room after. What happened there? Why didn't they give us more, you know? Why didn't they come back at us? They had one, I think Didier Hamann had a shot from 30 yards, and then they had one other shot, and that was it. In an FA Cup final, you would think that for that, everyone would be more motivated. But we needed an easy game. And my boy, we got an easy game. And then the Champions League final. But in that period, you don't think about it. You don't think about... Then we played the Champions League final, and what happened. And then everything for me just went blank, completely blank. I can't remember anything from then on until I sit in my car on my way home. I'm like this. What happened, you know? I'm completely confused. I came home. My family had traveled directly to Copenhagen, so I came home to an empty house as well. And I'm like that. What just happened? You know, couldn't understand it. And the thing is, from basically when the game was over till I'm in my car, I know a lot of stuff. But I all know that from people's stories, tales,
books,
videos I've seen, you know. It's really weird, and it's still like that.
It was an incredible career at United, finishing up with the Champions League, 5 Premier League titles. We've had some brilliant stories on United. You're going to stick with us because we want to talk about Denmark. We want to talk about the art of goalkeeping and how you changed it. We're going to be joined by Shay Given in a minute as well, but let's hear it for Peter Schmeichel. We are here at the RDS with thanks to Carlsberg, official partners of Irish football, and probably the best lager in the world.
Off the Ball on News Talk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.